Hey, everyone. Before we dive into the role that Latinos played in hip-hop culture, I just wanted to tell you about this other podcast. Take a listen to Microphone Check, hosted by Ali Shahid Muhammad from A Tribe Called Quest and Franny Kelly. They talk to the biggest names and the best-kept secrets in hip-hop, from behind-the-scenes players to the next generation of rappers, producers, and artists. Learn what's happening in the culture now and how we got here. You can find Microphone Check at npr.org/podcasts.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro. From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, this is Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario, in for Maria Hinojosa.
It's like anything in history, you know, and a lot of people don't know. And in New York, they don't know.
Sometimes people disappear from history. And in the case of hip-hop, those people are Latinos.
Those break beats, they have a lot to do with what was called Latin soul, Latin funk.
Today, we hear direct from Latinos who were there at the start of it all and how New York City made that possible.
People say the Bronx was on fire. I say the whole city was on fire.
We have all this and more today on Latino USA as we bring you the first in a two-part series, A Latino History of Hip Hop. I'm Daisy Rosario. Stay with us. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario, in for Maria Hinojosa. Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop and I recently got invited to a party. We'd been invited by this guy, Breakeasy. Real name? Richard Santiago. The party was in Queens, at the home of a man named Ralph Casanova, also known as King Uproc.
And what a party that was, huh, Daisy?
It was such a good time. There was arroz con habichuela.
There was lots of kids and families.
There was tattooing.
There was actually tattooing, that's true. And, of course, there were also all these really cool guys in their 50s who were once legends in hip-hop history in New York. So what you got here?
So I have, these are all old school rap records, from the first rap record to like 90s. Then I have disco, then I have funk, I have soul.
These men are B-boys, thus the B-boy names.
I like rock music. Then I have break beats, I got up rock.
They grew up during the early years of what became hip-hop. They danced and battled on the streets. They're still friends.
I got house.
Being there gave me the chance to ask important B-boy questions.
Cardboard versus linoleum. Pros and cons.
I like them both, you know.
A guy named Don Tony answered.
You know, that's what I learned how to break in cardboard, you know. There was a big refrigerator warehouse, and they used to throw away the biggest boxes. You know, when we got tired, we couldn't find them. Then, you know, we all started chipping in for linoleum.
And we were there to hear their stories.
It's like anything in history, you know. You want to know who the people who were there before, who did the work. And a lot of people don't know. And in New York, they don't know. It's a shame that I go to Russia. They know more history than the kids in New York.
All the MCs, I want you to know, if you ever want to battle me, don't move slow. Come and get it, because I'm waiting, and I got nowhere to go. Head to head, toe to toe, rock around, blow to blow, we can go.
Today on Latino USA, we're bringing you A Latino History of Hip Hop, Part 1.
You have many valuable people here that are still alive that can still do the movement, still understand the concept of what the dance was back then.
Starting with the down and dirty beginnings in New York City.
People come in and they'll tell you about someone else's history, but you never get it. Where did you play in this, you know? Like I said, there's many people that call themselves old school, but they were never active participants. They never took the floor. They never went out there. They never got to meet other people from other barrios, other boroughs, other states, if it went that far.
This is not the definitive history. It's real people telling you their stories.
There was hundreds of B-boys in the 80s. Hundreds, and the late 70s. So, you know, everybody has a story. You know what I'm saying?
Some of the people you may have heard of,
Others, maybe not.
Just because you saw a few people making, you know, traveling, that don't mean nothing. There was better B-boys than them. They just didn't have the, you know, the opportunity that they got, you know? Yeah. It happens to everybody, you know?
But these are people who were there, on the ground, in the streets, at a time when a new culture was being born.
Mostly everybody wrote graffiti. Everybody in the crew wrote graffiti. We had B-boys, we had DJs, we had MCs.
In part two, we'll talk more about how we got to now. But first,
my name is Raquel Z. Rivera.
She's a visiting scholar at the University of New Mexico.
And I'm the author of the book New Yorkans from the Hip Hop Zone.
She'll be with us throughout the episode. Now, we're not just talking about hip hop as in rap music. We're talking about a whole culture. Born on the streets of a multi-ethnic New York City.
Puerto Ricans and African Americans, two groups among many others, other people from the Caribbean, also Latino and not Latino, they were neighbors, they were friends.
And that's an important distinction.
That multi-ethnic experience is really hard to understand one aspect of hip-hop, namely the musical part, becomes hyper-commercialized. The musical part became identified as an African-American thing. It's a sticky debate.
To say the debate is sticky is an understatement.
Of course, it's rooted in a painful history of cultural appropriation from African Americans by other people.
To me, hip-hop, particularly the music, is a Black American form. But even that's complicated.
Latinos are a multiracial people, and there are very dark-skinned Latinos and very light-skinned Latinos. So where do those people fit in?
Some Latinos are Black. Some are white. Some don't identify as either.
I want to stress how reality is always so much more complex than the national labels or the racial labels or the ethnic labels that we want to impose on cultural expression. I just want to encourage us all to keep in mind that it's a lot more complex than labels suggest.
Plus,
it's tricky to understand from outside the New York context.
So let's talk about that context. Oh, and don't worry, West Coast. We definitely talk more about you in part two. So it's the late 1970s in New York City.
Severely economically depressed New York City. There was migration, out-migration from people who could afford to escape the city, which was usually white people. There was the torching of buildings.
Landlords in poor areas like the South Bronx were setting their buildings on fire to collect on the insurance.
The Bronx was a symbol, a national symbol of urban blight. Eve of destruction, tax deduction,
price inflation, rocks the nation. Another B-boy, Rick Soto, said,
people say the Bronx was on fire. I say the whole city was on fire. The Bronx had sections on fire. They will say, oh, Manhattan was on fire. Yes, it was. Maybe not the city, but Washington Heights was on fire. Right? Parts of Queens was on fire. Parts of Bushwick, Williamsburg was on fire. You know, one time a guy reported, asked me, yo, what's different today from back then? I told him the air. He said, what do you mean? I said, the air is different. You don't smell the fire no more.
And this is how graffiti legend Lee Quiñones described it.
The whole city. I mean, the Lower East Side was burning just as much as the Bronx. And when people ask me, how do you remember the Bronx in the 70s and 80s? I say to them, I remember a dim, distinct glow or hue of orange fire at night. And going through those neighborhoods and seeing that this whole, you know, everything was a fuse. It was going up.
This is the reality of New York City at that time.
Hip-hop came out of very painful, stressful circumstances among groups that were sharing these social circumstances and at the same time were trying to make the best of it. Broken glass everywhere. People pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care.
I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to provide, I guess I got no choice. And a culture was born. But what do we mean by hip-hop culture as opposed to specifically rap music?
It depends on who you ask. The most accepted four elements of hip-hop are the visual arts side of it, graffiti and other related visual art forms, the DJ side of it, the rap side of it, and the b-boy, b-girl, and other related dance styles aspect.
People argue about other elements, but those four are the ones we're focusing on today.
It was DJing, MCing, dancing, doing it all.
And we start with the b-boy, b-girl aspect, the dancing, which is particularly near and dear to my own heart. Hey, Mom. How you doing?
Hey. I'm nervous. You know me.
Don't be nervous. We're just going to chat. When she was young, my mom, Bruni Lopez, was one of these teenagers competing in the streets of Brooklyn. I grew up listening to her stories.
It's something in the beat that just got me going.
To this day, her favorite song is Planet Rock by Afrika Bambaataa and the Soul Sonic Force. I asked her to imagine being back there and tell me about it.
Oh my God, I could actually picture that exactly. Hanging on the sideline with the guys, and all of a sudden, Dad would come in, and that's it. I was in the middle of the floor going.
It was and still is the time of her life that she speaks of with the most passion.
Loved it, will always love it, and I wish that I can still do it today.
The B-boys we met earlier, like Breakeasy, they do still do it today. And they've got the same touchstones.
Why? Because the sound that was coming out of that time frame was an 808 drum machine, which is Planet Rock. Rock, rock to the Planet Rock. Don't stop.
Just like my mom, Breakeasy was the sort of person who couldn't help but move.
Yo quería moverme. I was a shaker. I wanted to get down and get everything done. If you listen to the Latin sounds, you're moving everything. You know, you're not in place and just stop motion. You're moving though, la cadera, la pierna, los brazos, tú estás dando gloria a Dios, whatever.
Songs like Planet Rock came later. When Breakeasy first started dancing, before people were using the term b-boy, it was actually more common to dance to funk.
Now, mind you, that funk was not your, what you would call like a Rick James super freak type of funk. It was a very dirty sound. It was a live instrument sound.
He already danced a few different styles when he started noticing something else.
I'm like, wow, I can dig that. So I'm looking around. I'm seeing other kids experimenting with this movement. So I'm like, okay, let me experiment along with that. Let me copy what they're doing on the top and do the stuff on the floor. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, wow, this is called breaking. This is breaking. This is b-boying. Wow, look what. Check this out. This is cool.
Breakeasy and his friends were growing up on the south side of Williamsburg in Brooklyn.
We're hearing about other kids doing it in other barrios. The east side. Up in the Bronx, up in Manhattan, all the kids are catching on to this, and they're creating crews. So what do? I associate myself with other guys that learn the same thing, and we create a crew.
When we return, Breakeasy talks about the b-boy life. And we meet DJ Charlie Chase.
Can't go from your T.O. And she's so, I said, so, baby, don't you know I can sing, rap, dance, missing just one show, cause I'm can't go, Mr. Sophisticator. As far as I know, ain't nobody greater from beginning to end and to beginning. I never lose because I'm all about winning, but if I was to lose, I wouldn't be the same, cause I'm not a gambler. I don't bet, I don't be in no casino. And baby, why you nizzle? The is, the grizzly, kizzle and kizzle. I thought you'd be impressed and give me devious rap. I thought I had a thing inside my sinister trap. I thought it'd be a piece of paper, but it was nothing like that. I guess that's what I keep a thinking, ain't that right, black? Bitch, Chris, I can do some, and see this, I'm a wizard. Chris, who is, I can tease her up his ass just like a gizzle with a bang, bang, brother, I feel bad, but I ain't committing suicide.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, exotic and domestic hardwood, bamboo, and cork. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org.
One, two, three, four, get it!
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario in for Maria Hinojosa. Today we are bringing you a Latino history of hip-hop, oral history from Latinos who lived it. This is part one of two, this one focusing on the very early years in New York City. We'll get to other parts of the country next time. But right now, we're talking about one of the four elements that make up hip-hop culture, breakdancing.
That's the reason why most of the guys dance. Because you wanted the girls' eye on you. Because the girls at that time loved to dance. And the guys needed to learn how to dance in order to get with the girl.
This is Richard Santiago again, also known as Break Easy, explaining his original motivation. The people who developed this culture were young, and there was some innocence to it.
It's funny because we're just kids, and for us, getting girls just meant being able to go on a date, kiss, and maybe get a digit. And that's as far as it went. If you were able to just get a number and talk to a girl, you were right on the money.
But just because there was innocence doesn't mean these kids were completely innocent.
We were street rats. Was I a good kid at a young age? I was not your typical good kid as a child. I remember I used to come home being hit because, what was I doing? Going into abandoned buildings.
It was in these abandoned buildings that Richard and other kids practiced.
We were all learning from each other and building it and making it up as we went along. All we had was the music to dictate us what to do.
But you still wanted to develop moves.
My first move was a hand spin. Tap, tap, tap. And then started getting funky on the top, with top rock, then down to footwork. It reciprocated itself from top to bottom, bottom to top. I've learned to master that what you do on the floor, you can do on the top.
That mastery led to him getting his name.
Because people used to see me dance, they would say, wow, you make it look so easy.
Thus, Break Easy was born. Having smooth moves was one thing. Going up against other dancers in a battle was something else.
The battles were pretty intense because somebody would come in with a boombox. And back then, you had somebody that had either recorded from the radio, tape, and stopped. Pause, stop, pause, stop, pause. Some of the best tracks to use for a battle. So mind you, you have a cassette that's 60 minutes, and you got to flip it. So every 30 minutes, you will have to flip it.
No smartphones, no downloadable music, no social media. Yet information about battles still got around.
They were voiced through the streets like, yeah, let this crew know that we're going to battle this crew. At least 24 hours in advance because everybody would pass the word around. Call somebody's house. Yeah, Vinny, I heard this. Oh, yeah, Richie, tell Angel. Angel, tell the twins. Okay, cool.
They also kept up with other crews this way.
What did you see? Was there something different? What crew is good? Can we battle them? Can we take them?
Because if you're going to battle, you want to win.
You had to know that. You want to win that guy? Beat him at his own move. Do it before he does. Play the card before they do. You see the people that are around you? Make them get into your side. How do you do it? Humiliate the guy. How do you do it? Be the show off.
The competitive nature of battles suited Richard.
You know, as a Puerto Rican, some other reason. If there's not, you tell us, I can't do it. I'm going to tell you, watch me.
Break Easy and his friends pulled inspiration from things they loved.
3 o'clock Saturday, no kid was in the street because they'd be watching from 3 to 5 one of the kung fu movies, Shaolin or the Five Fingers of Death, the Five Deadly Venom.
It's number 2, the snake. So it was your idea.
You saw all these things. So what you do, you will see the way those kung fu artists would do flips and bridges, and you incorporate it in your movement.
They also incorporated things that were popular with everyone.
Everybody was crazy over the fact that Tutankhamun, the mummy, is arriving to New York. That's all you saw on TV. You saw it on newspapers. So we're looking at the way the hands are shaped. Boom, boom. So we're copying the hieroglyphics that were there. Then somebody said, you know what? When you look at the hieroglyphic, it's boring. You know why? Because it gets so flat. What if it was 3D? It's all energy. That's what kids need. That's why today I try to look for those kids that need a form to express themselves.
In the mid-90s, after some time with the Marines, Richard found himself teaching these moves to the next generation. And he still does it now.
You go to McCann Park anytime during the summer, in on the track field, you can find a collective of b-boys in the corner with linoleum and a boombox, and maybe 90% of the time you'll probably see me there.
But when it's too cold to go to McCarran Park in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, they head indoors. So Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop and I went to visit one of Breakeasy's drop-in practices.
The practice sessions are being monitored and conducted by the Grand Street Settlement.
The walls are bright green. There are math textbooks by the door. School desks and chairs have been pushed to the walls. A handful of b-boys and one b-girl are taking turns trying out their moves in the middle of the room.
Currently, a lot of these b-boys are working on perfecting certain moves so they drill themselves. You know, some of them drill themselves for the music. Others drill themselves just for the movement itself.
Everyone seems really advanced.
Marlon is slightly intimidated.
It seems like they're advanced, but believe it or not, a lot of the moves that you've been watching have been a lot of fundamentals. Usually, I get down with them and stuff so they can see that. At my age, I can still get down, still do what they do. Of course, not with the same high energy as them, but still go through the movement. So that's enough for them to look and say, you know what, at that age, I should be able to do it if he's able to do it, and maybe even could take it further.
Breakeasy says this, but honestly, the guy is ripped. He's not big and bulky, but toned and compact, like a yoga teacher or a gymnast. Teaching keeps him fit, but it also lets him give back, keep that spirit alive, and pass it along to another generation of B-girls and B-boys. Here's one of the guys from the practice, Mike Rivera, a.k.a. Steps.
People don't understand. People think that we're just, like, spinning around and doing all this crazy, ridiculous, excuse my French, but, and we look like monkeys and we look like we don't know what we're doing, but it's, we learn a lot more than just moves. We learn a culture. We learn how we talk. We learn how to dress. We learn discipline.
Oh, and I should mention, Breakeasy runs these practices for free. Yeah. Free. It's yet another thing the students pick up from him. Aaron Goodwin, aka Goody Goodness, helps run things.
They're like my family now. Like, I think that was the big draw. And also because the people who are really into it are so passionate and, you know, they love the dance.
For Aaron, her teacher's passion has inspired her to keep learning, no matter what.
When they hear that song, oh, they just can't control themselves. And I have that feeling inside me too, so I love being around people like that, and I guess it just I couldn't leave after that. I'm like, I don't care if I suck, I'm gonna keep going till I get better.
And in a now very different Brooklyn, another generation of b-boys and b-girls is born.
I remember how it all began. I used to sing dirty raps to my East Side fans back then. I knew you couldn't stop this rap. No,
everything is vibing off each other. The people rapping need music. They need a DJ. The people dancing need something to dance to. The DJs and the rappers are reacting to what's going on the dance floor. So it's all part of the same fabric.
Of course, there would have been nothing for the B-boys and B-girls of New York to dance to without one of the other elements, the DJ. Hey, Charlie Chase.
Hello.
So we decided to find a DJ for ourselves. I'm Daisy. Nice to talk to you.
Pleasure meeting you, Daisy.
Carlos Mundus, a.k.a. DJ Charlie Chase, was a founding member of the Cold Crush Brothers, one of the very first and most important hip-hop groups to form in New York back in the 1970s. Let's start, you know, kind of just at the beginning. Like, how did you get involved in DJing, in the music scene at the time, you know, kind of on a professional level?
I come from a family of musicians, first of all. You know, my dad and my grandfather were guitar players playing in these trios and, you know, out of Puerto Rico singing these love ballads, you know.
As a teen, Charlie learned to play the bass. He played in all sorts of bands, including salsa.
While I was in a salsa band, my keyboard player was a DJ. So one day I went to pick him up. We had a gig, and I stopped off at his house. And when I went inside, I saw him messing around with the turntables and a mixer. I'm a nerd. So when I see electronics and stuff, I gravitate to that. So I was intrigued by the way he was working it, and that got me started into that.
Just to be clear, we're not talking about just playing records back-to-back the way DJs were doing at the disco clubs downtown. This style of DJing, what was in Charlie's neighborhood in the Bronx and similar neighborhoods around the city, this was something else.
The way the hip-hop DJ started was we were playing breakbeats. We weren't playing whole songs. We were not playing the entire version of Aerosmith's Walk This Way. We were playing the beginning 8 bars. And then we would need 2 records, and then we would play them back to back.
The idea was to find a good break, a catchy instrumental breakdown in a song, and then loop it over and over for rappers to rhyme on top of. Charlie got to practicing.
You know, I was a kid, didn't have many responsibilities, so there were a lot of hours that I locked myself up in a room and just go on it.
And since he was a musician, Charlie treated the turntable not just as this machine that plays records, but as an instrument.
You know, practicing on how to just basically how to just throw the record in. That was the first thing I needed to learn how to do, was just throw the record in. Then after I got that, I had to perfect stab, you know, throwing stabs. That's when you take the record, throw it in and cut it out. Throw it in and cut it out. Throw it in and cut it out repeatedly. Those are stabs. I'll be honest with you, man. I was sick with this. I was locked in a room for hours, nonstop, just banging away on there, man, for days and months and days and months until I felt that I was good enough to go out.
But to go out, Charlie needed more than skills. He needed an arsenal of music to play. And just like Breakeasy and the B-Boys on the streets, he didn't have much money. So he improvised with what he could get his hands on.
We would go into our parents' collection. I did. I went into my parents' collection. I had friends whose parents were throwing records out. I'd take those out of the garbage and take them home and look through them, you know. I'd go in the record stores looking for the new beats, for new records that might have had some new stuff that people haven't even heard before, some obscure stuff.
The records that were most popular with hip-hop DJs were funk records. But there was often a Latin flavor to them as well.
The funkiest stuff always has these Latin influences to it. Like, I got some tracks from Ray Barreto that are hot, Joe Bataan, you know, that are hot.
Those break beats, they have a lot to do with what was called Latin soul, Latin funk.
Raquel Rivera.
Timbales, congas, so there was that Caribbean Latino influence, and it goes both ways.
Take, for example, this track, It's Just Begun, by the Jimmy Castor Bunch. It was a very popular breakbeat with B-Boys during this era, and it's dripping in Latin percussion. In 1978, Charlie and DJ Tony Tone founded the Cold Crush Brothers, putting together a group of MCs who were popular in the park jams like Grandmaster Caz and JDL. Even before their debut record came out in 1982, their bootleg tapes were widely passed around the Northeast. What did your family think of, like, you being interested in this type of music? You know, was it something where they were like, oh, cool, what's this? Or were they were like, no, 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 stick to what we know?
My mom was always, she would, like, I would play out in the park across the street. It was 118 Park. I would play there, and I would keep everyone up in the neighborhood, and they would complain and stuff. We'd be up there till like 2 or 3 in the morning, rocking, you know? And my mom would complain about, what are you doing? Everybody's complaining. You're keeping them all up at all hours of the night. You know, you're just playing in the parks. Why don't you do like Julio down the street? He's making $200 a night playing this and playing that. I'm like, Mom, I don't want to do what Julio's doing. I want to do this. This is what I want to do, you know? The train was late in your heart, the eight plus. She wish you stayed in bed Tuesday. You ran a game on your favorite day, but then she messed up your head Wednesday. And she wasn't the only person that I was catching that kind of heat from. I mean, that's the motherly heat. I was basically getting a lot of heat from the blacks and the Latinos for doing what I was doing.
We heard this kind of thing from a lot of the people we interviewed for this episode. Puerto Ricans who were drawn to hip hop in its early days often found their participation questioned. Here's Raquel.
It came from the older generation of Latinos, the parents whose children were DJing and rapping, and they were like, oh my God, stop that noise. What is that? You know, you're adopting that other music that doesn't belong to us. And in the same way, some young African Americans, even, you know, part of that same realm, it was like, you know, wait a minute, this is ours. You know, your music is that other music in Spanish. There were those tensions. But at the same time, these groups and these people were all making music and making a social scene and a cultural scene together.
Charlie Chase was one of the very first known Latin DJs in hip hop and one of the most visible Latinos in hip hop's early period overall. Today, he looks back and realizes that he probably opened up the door for a lot of people. But at the time, he wasn't thinking about his identity as a Puerto Rican in hip hop.
I grew up in a black and Puerto Rican neighborhood. My mom was never prejudiced, you know, and we were never raised to think like we were separate from anybody else. So me playing music amongst all these people and the people that showed up at the schoolyards were Latino and black. And white, too, you know? So I never did see that. I think that I first started noticing that I was different from anybody else. One day, we had a Zulu Nation meeting.
Zulu Nation was the collective started by hip-hop pioneer Afrika Bambaataa. Charlie was a member.
One of the guys stood up in the audience and said, we got to give props to the first Puerto Rican DJ in hip-hop, Charlie Chase. And when he said that, I looked at him like, what? You know, like, I have never thought about it that way. I never looked at it that way. And when he made that comment, it just like this whole, like this book in my mind just started going through all the pages in my past. And I'm like, you know what? I can kind of see where he's coming from with this, you know? And that's when I first noticed that I was sticking out more than a lot of the rest of the guys, that I was different.
These days, Charlie lives in Tampa, Florida. He's still active as a DJ. Not just near home. He still travels all over. Coming up, a Latino history of hip-hop continues as we meet the first Latino rapper signed to a major label, and graffiti art pioneer Lee Quiñones.
Hey, everyone. I know you're loving this hip-hop-centric episode of Latino USA, which is hot. But if you want to know more about the genre, maybe you want to listen to this podcast. Take a listen to Microphone Check, hosted by Ali Shaheed Muhammad from A Tribe Called Quest and Franny Kelly. They talk to the biggest names and the best-kept secrets in hip-hop, from behind-the-scenes players to the next generation of rappers, producers, and artists. Learn what's happening in the culture now and how we got here. You can find Microphone Check at npr.org/podcasts.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, supporting efforts to improve women's economic opportunities around the world. More information is available at hewlett.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario in for Maria Hinojosa. Today, part one of a two-part series looking at the contributions of Latinos to hip-hop culture. So far, we've heard from Latino breakdancers and DJ Charlie Chase. They told us about the very early period of hip-hop's development before it was even really called hip-hop. And these are only two of what are considered the four elements. The other two are graffiti and MCing. MCs, by the way, are rappers for the non-hip-hop inclined out there. Latinos were probably the least visible on the mic when compared to the other four elements, but they were still very much present, especially in the early years.
Absolutely they were. Many of the early iconic rap groups like the Fabulous Five and the Fat Boys had Latino MCs in their ranks.
My fellow Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop is back with me.
Hey, Daisy.
Hey. So Marlon, when you say groups, we should explain that while there are a lot of solo hip-hop artists now, in the late 70s, early 80s, it was all about the rap group.
That's right. I interviewed a guy named The Devastating Tito.
I'm from the pioneering group, The Fearless Four. Wow. Hold on. let's start that again.
That was Biz Markie calling, by the way.
Yo, Biz, I'm in the middle of...
You know, just in case you question Tito's hip-hop cred.
So the Fearless Four aren't one of the best remembered groups of that time period, but they did make history by becoming the first rap group to ever to be signed to a major label. So before we get to the Fearless Four, Tito grew up in Harlem, right near our offices here on 125th Street. His family, like so many others at the time, moved from Puerto Rico in search of economic opportunities. He quickly fell in with the people in his new Harlem home.
I used to stay with the brothers a lot. You know, I grew up around that.
And from Tito's personality when he was young, you'd never guess that he'd end up on stage or in front of a microphone.
I was a real shy, timid guy. Like, I wouldn't really, didn't know how to talk to the girls. So that, I seen what that did. I went out and seen other DJs and MCs talk on the mic, and I seen how the girls would just gravitate to them. And I was like, wow, yo, look at them girls. Like, the girls, it was almost like a magnet, right? So I said, maybe if I learn how to do that, maybe I could have some success with them. And sure enough.
And so Tito started picking up the mic at the park jams and parties, and he'd freestyle over the beats that the DJs were playing.
Yo, Shorty, that's what you call me. Shorty, Shorty, wow, look at Shorty. I was a little dude, you know. So for me to get that kind of attention, it changed everything for me. Like, I mean, my self-esteem was growing.
Eventually, Tito started the Fearless Four with some other kids he met at a school talent show. And Tito has this classic story about how his group got signed to their first record deal. At first, their goal was to get signed by Bobby Robinson, a gentleman who ran a small record shop and indie music label called Enjoy Records out of a storefront in Harlem.
We would come there, play hooky, and go to that spot every day.
So one day, they knocked on the door, and Bobby Robinson's assistant opened up.
What's happening? What are you trying to sell? Yo, why don't you just hear us? Why don't you just hear us and then, you know, make your decision? You could tell Bobby about us. So the guy said, come on in. And we started it. Well, I could rock a rhyme from the time 9 to 6, and I could do the same if only I had the mix. Well, I could wave my hand and part the sea. Well, I could wink my eye and have the girls come to me. And the guy was like, oh, shit. You know, like, I never heard this kind of rap.
They impressed the assistant enough that they got an audience with Bobby Robinson himself, who offered them a deal basically on the spot.
Get these contracts back to me. We went in the next night to record. Our song was out the next week. That was the beginning of the Fearless Four, like professionally, 1981.
That was the Fearless Four's first record, It's Magic. Tito was only 16 years old. And things kept getting better for the Fearless Four. In 82, they released their next record, Rockin' It, and it was a huge hit. It did so well that it got the attention of executives at Elektra, which was a major label at the time, and they got a record deal. But because hip-hop was so new to the industry, the label just didn't really know how to market the group.
The places, they were sending our records to where they sent Linda Ronstadt. The guys don't understand it. They're like, what do you want us to do with this? Like, where do we put these guys?
And after a few records that did just okay, the Fearless Four was dropped from the label, and they broke up in 1985. But the reason Tito's story is important, I think, is because it illustrates how, when you look at that really early history of hip-hop in those early days, Latinos were present at every important moment. In this case, we're talking about the first time a hip-hop group was signed to a major label, and Devastating Tito was there. This is Raquel Rivera again, the scholar we've been hearing from throughout the program. She says there were lots of Latinos in rap groups back in the day. There was Charlie Chase and the Cold Crush Brothers, who we heard from, and Prince Whipper Whip and Ruby Dee of the Fantastic Five, and Prince Marky D. Morales of the Fat Boys.
Many people, they didn't know and perhaps didn't care that they were Latino.
And in the case of some of those guys, again, you can't always tell they're Latino by looking at them.
And as time went on, it became more explicitly African-American, especially towards the late 80s, when there was this strong emphasis on racial politics and racial justice. This was a music that many New York-raised Latinos considered their music, even like their primary musical language. They knew hip-hop better than they knew the quote-unquote Latino music.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was definitely true for me even years later. When I was growing up, I probably couldn't have named you a single specific salsa song, but I always had EPMD or Eric B. and Rakim cassettes in my backpack.
But the shift in the industry didn't stop Tito from being a part of hip-hop. He still raps to this day and makes mixtapes. He also runs an award show that's all about honoring artists who really didn't get their due in hip-hop and other genres.
He also makes a point of doing youth outreach.
By the way, there's a big Latino comeback in commercial rap music that happens in the 90s, and we're going to talk all about it in A Latino History of Hip-Hop, Part 2.
We promise it will be the most Cypress Hill and Big Pun you've ever heard on public radio. One place in hip-hop culture where Latinos' presence has never been questioned, however, is graffiti. It's the art part of the four elements that we've been talking about on today's program. And to talk about graffiti, Marlon and I decided to start in the obvious place, outside.
Yeah, this is 2nd Street and Avenue A, passionately known as The Avenue. If you was on Avenue A back in the 70s and 80s, you was on the good spot. Once you went past Avenue B, you was on the dark side. And the Avenue was buck wild. You saw everything and anything in the Avenue.
We went to New York's Lower East Side with Lee Quiñones. In case you can't tell, he grew up around here.
I grew up in the projects on the waterfront, and I had a funny melting pot happening around me. The Chinese gangsters in Chinatown, the Italian mobsters across the street, and the Puerto Ricans and the blacks in the projects. It was such a great, like, big fishbowl, you know?
This is the type of multi-ethnic area you could find in New York City, especially during this era.
Lee's not just any graffiti artist. He's one of graffiti's creators and greatest stylists.
Gracias.
He invited us to talk to him at his favorite Italian restaurant in the neighborhood.
That's so good right there.
It was very delicious.
Now, when you think of graffiti, you might think writing your name on a wall, but Lee's work was on a completely different scale.
From the age of 14, he would take the train out to the end of the line and sneak into the train depots at night to paint.
It was a way of me just kind of like dislodging myself from the neighborhood and changing into that superhero that I felt I was at that time, you know.
Once there, he'd spend hours painting elaborate murals that covered entire subway cars.
Why the trains, of all places, to paint?
Literally the vehicle of choice. Conceptually, it was ingenious. The sense of movement, like having your name in motion, made it feel more powerful than itself. You know, it gave it life, it gave it legs. You sculpted your life, you sculpted your legacy on those trains.
Back in the 70s and 80s, the subways were completely covered in graffiti, inside and out.
These tagged up trains were often cited as an example of everything that was wrong with New York at the time. The decay, the decline.
But people like Lee saw their potential. What did it look like back then? I mean, what did the trains look like?
Oh, God. It was the after party at your parents' house, you know, where everybody left to the next party and left your place trashed. The train cars were old and rusting at that time. We were like a visual maintenance.
Visual maintenance. I love that. And if you look at the murals Lee did, they're really impressive. They're bold, bright, artistic. And these works would just travel all over the city.
To picture it, I mean, I can see you do this amazing piece of art, and then you're hanging out in the LAS, you're by home, but that train is in the Bronx, and a couple hours later it's in Brooklyn. So it's moving everywhere.
It's definitely your Insta... It's your Insta damn, you know, at that time, because kids in East New York are going, who's this guy? And oh, who are these people, this group of people? And you haven't even met them or never will. But they have met you through the art, and you have met them spiritually through the creation of art.
Lee told us that an activity that kids would do back then is just hang out and watch trains pass for hours, looking out for new murals.
Literal train spotting.
People were talking about my work in school, saying, yo, you should see the new Lee car. Oh, my God, yo, you got it. And people would run to those stations to wait hours, as I did, for that train to come back in service on the opposite route and see it. And then, and you know, and it only came for seconds at a time. And then it would leave. And you was left with this vacuum of like, whoa, yo.
You can get a sense of what this was like in the 1983 cult film Wild Style. The movie used actual graffiti writers and hip-hop artists as actors and introduced a lot of people around the U.S. and the world to the sights and sounds of hip-hop culture.
Lee Quiñones starred in the movie. He basically played himself, a young Latino graffiti writer with big dreams. In the scene we're hearing right now, he and some friends are watching trains and politicking about the graffiti scene.
How can you call people to hang out in windows and watch trains writers, man? You gotta write, you gotta do the action.
At what point do you go, this is a career, this is who I am, Lee Quiñones artist, I don't have to do other things?
When I did my first handball wall murals in 1978, and I was 18 years old, and I felt like I arrived as an artist.
So if you haven't heard of handball, it's a street sport that was especially popular in New York at the time. The courts are basically these big slabs of concrete.
Growing up, it felt like there were handball courts everywhere.
I just, you know what it was? I felt like I had exhausted the trains to a certain point that I had just like, there was no more to say within that space. And I like challenges. I love adventure. And I saw those walls as tablets. Sort of tablets of yore, and I was like, I'm going to paint that entire handball wall in one sitting, in one night. I'm going to do something that I have never thought I could do.
And Lee's courts are really special.
His first one is probably my favorite of the ones I've seen. It features Howard the Duck. I mean, they're all amazing, but I'm also a comics nerd.
The handball court murals got the attention of figures in the so-called fine art world. People like Keith Haring and Jean-Michel Basquiat, and ended up sending Lee on a whole new trajectory.
He presented his first art show at age 19 in Rome. An Italian collector saw his murals and was blown away by this fresh new style of painting. It was a game-changing moment for street art.
People were like, did you hear that Lee and Fat Freddy had a show in Rome, Italy? It was unheard of. everybody was like stunned. And I think most of my peers here in New York were like, wow, what do we do now?
Today, Lee no longer paints on trains or handball courts. He paints in a studio and he shows in galleries. Sure, he doesn't have to worry about getting arrested anymore, but there are new challenges.
It's a little different now in the art world, how you navigate through things, but you have to navigate through a lot of obstacles then too. And now you have to navigate to return to gaining respect as a living, standing artist, because people will always throw you back to the back of the bus.
Lee's made an impact on the art world in his own way, and since he first started painting trains as a teenager, so-called street art has become a big industry. Just think of Banksy, who Forbes estimates to be worth $20 million. But Lee says that graffiti artists from his generation are still treated with a certain disrespect by the art establishment.
People think that we don't have an intellectual ability to explain ourselves.
In other words, Lee says graffiti artists are often treated as a kind of exotic urban phenomenon, rather than being taken seriously as individual artists with individual visions. And he says that's a mistake, because the marginalized spaces, the hood, that's where some of the brightest creativity is happening.
Like I said, there's more to be found in places that you don't expect to find art. And when people are underprivileged and, you know, maybe even culturally incarcerated, you just want to have that voice. You want to have a loud voice. You know, they have so much to say, and it's such from a pure place. It's like a sucker punch. Bam! Gotcha! You need to think about that one, right? Check this one out. Boom! You know, that's what art is. It reinvents itself. If it doesn't, we're dead in the water. We're dead in the water.
Today, we've heard directly from Latinos who helped shape each of the four elements of hip-hop, the dancing, the DJing, the MCing, the graffiti writing.
But all that stuff, the four elements, as you call it, really doesn't mean anything. And there's a fifth part, which a lot of people forget.
That's Richard Santiago again, a.k.a. Break Easy, our sort of b-boy sensei. So what exactly is this fifth element? Some say it's fashion. Some of the people we interviewed said things like knowledge. But Break Easy has a different answer.
It's like your hand. You can grab anything with four fingers. But you know what? None of that can really hold true unless you have that thumb. And that thumb happens to be what I call creative unity. It's understanding and respecting those four to make it all happen.
In other words, Richard says, that fifth element is the vision that brings all the other elements together. It's the through line that links all these cultural expressions. And as we've heard today, the story of hip-hop is the story of young people making something fresh and optimistic in the toughest of circumstances, carving out a space for themselves. Here's Raquel Rivera again.
It comes out of really dire circumstances, and it's incredible, amazing, beautiful what young people came up with. And when we think about how young these people were, like, Teenagers came up with this history that we're talking today, you know, wow, these skills, these were kids. And it's amazing what they came up with.
Hip hop is about resilience. And if you really love it, you know that's proven to be true even to this day. Something teenagers created as New York City crumbled around them has had a huge impact on culture around the world. This episode is just a little reminder that in that time and in that place, Latinos were there. And for this New Yorican hip-hop head, that's something to be really proud of. And that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, me, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camila Vargas, and Antonia Cerejito. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes everything happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm Daisy Rosario, honored to step in for our host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa, on this special episode. Join us again next week and keep an ear out for a Latino History of Hip Hop Part 2 coming very, very soon. In the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and of course, on Instagram.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all.
the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security. At carnegie.org.
I miss you.
Oh my God, you put that on the radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, with a floor finder app to help find sustainably harvested flooring, including exotic and domestic hardwood, bamboo, and cork. More information is available at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Hey, mis queridos. I just want to take a moment to give a special shout out to some of our listeners in California, Texas, Massachusetts, and New Mexico. You know who you are, and I just want to say thank you so much for taking a moment and clicking on the donate button at latinousa.org. Your contributions of whatever size truly make a difference for us. Gracias for believing in the content Latino USA produces.